Blog Talk Radio.
Getting it right with Dr. Bowles. Today's topic, social justice, American wealth and political corruption. We are here March 3rd, 2016. And the United States of America, one of the greatest industrialized country of all time in modern world. And we are going through a decision of who will lead this country through a very comical process. I've had friends from international areas contact me and say, is it a spoof? You have someone like Donald Trump really running for president and winning. And I don't have a lot of voice in explaining what's going on because I truly do not understand. The method by which we allow 10 or 12 persons to jump out and start saying, I want to be president and I want to represent the Republican Party, I want to represent the Democratic Party, and so forth, those who have very deep pockets can have television campaigns and all kinds of social media information, international kind of information, and the world is watching. And for at least 6 months, it's like a comedy or a variety show. I remember I like the oldies, and I watch the stations that show them, and Dean Martin had a show where he'd have his friends come, and they'd go through all kinds of antics and comedies, and it was for the entertainment of the people, and it was a time when America needed something to laugh at. Well, when I see the various debates, Republican debate, Democratic debate, it makes me think of Dean Martin variety show or Carol Burnett variety show, where they show the extreme buffoonery of some of the Americans' antics. One of our greatest exposers, if you like, was Jerry Lewis. And I think the French saw him as most amusing, and unfortunately a lot of the world saw him as a representative of the American personality. Today, United States of America, I don't know who it is that advises or keeps an eye on standing, a world standing, a moral standing. I don't know much about politics because I'm not among the wealthy. I have, in this last half century, come to understand that money, in fact, is power. And money in America is big. And I can actually say I observed over the last 20 years of an evolution where we've begun to create a character, that we put out business books, and the mighty MBA was what you had to have to even have any hope of advancing in a corporate world. And the people who emerged with more money were those who could tell the public how to be ruthless, how to focus on very small paradigms and go forth. And these voices have been the ones most heard. The Harvard Business Schools and the other business schools came out with the 40 properties of this and the 20 properties of that and how to have power. We got so greedy and so hungry for this ruthless behavior they had at one time, the television program, which starred our now presidential front runner, Trump, who his famous lines were, you're fired. And I couldn't stomach watching the program because it was angry and it was bullish. And the people that he dismissed were not simply dismissed, they were ridiculed and stripped of any dignity. And that was American entertainment. Well, now here we are. American entertainment now essentially is becoming American reality. Those of us who have a sense of reason, and those of us who are trying to live among the world as a good citizen, a good world citizen, have to watch this buffoonery. We hear someone who declares we need to build a wall, and how many years did we work to try to get walls torn down when it came to the wall in Germany? And there is someone who says he would evict the immigrant. And if you look at history, or if you have any sense of history, or if you've lived in the southern states, you know that there has been a major industry of bringing in migrant workers. When I was in South Carolina, I had a clinic in Somerville, and Somerville's a lovely little city, but it's adjacent to a pea or agricultural pea crop. So every so often, there would just be this abundance of Mexicans. And how I became aware of it is I was running a clinic for both adult and children, and I would get a number of Mexican children coming in. And when I'd get any kind of data, any history, I'd find out this child's never been immunized and so forth. And I certainly worked. And I have to say kudos to the nursing industry and nursing corporations in South Carolina. I did work primarily with the nursing system. They were very, very, very helpful in my being able to immunize what was considered illegal aliens, but the children were born in America, and by our own declaration, they were Americans. And I got good support from the nursing, national nursing, and I suppose state nursing groups, and we were able to accommodate. But what I learned in all of those efforts is that there was a organized system of bringing in undocumented migrant workers, because they didn't pay them much. And many of these workers lived in tents or in abandoned buildings. And though few brought their families, some had the hope of having a child born here so that they could stay. But if you would hear the campaign comments, particularly from the front runner of the Republican Party, Mr. Trump, he would gather them all, children and adults, and send them back. And there are some who would cheer at that. But I'm waiting for the voice of reason saying, well, what? How did they get here in the first place? There were trucks sent. They were picked up. They were brought here. And it's almost the concept of using. There's a person, I don't think that I'd quote this person if I were trying to impress you, because I certainly don't know, think the character that this person expressed is one that represents, hopefully, the world. But his comment was about women. He was quite a womanizer. And we were talking about his one-night stands or his promiscuity. And he said, well, I look at women sometimes like a Kleenex. I do my business, and then I discard them. And that's how that popped into my mind. When I said, okay, so it's like a dirty tissue, a used tissue. You bring them, they pick the crop, they do whatever menial tasks that you can have done for the minimal amount of income, and then you want them to disappear. You want them to become invisible. In that thinking, it reminds me of some of the literature I read immediately after August 29, 2005, which for anyone coming out of New Orleans know that's when Hurricane Katrina came into our city. And a very courageous writer wrote that the black Americans in New Orleans gave the rhythm, the flavor, the savor of the New Orleans, you know, the music and the dance and the milieu, if you like, the hospitality and the big hotels and airports. You had your shoeshine people in the airports. You had your tap dancers in the quarter. You had your funky butt club right off of the business district. And when you came to New Orleans, you came to a different kind of setting, almost Caribbean, African kind of setting. And once Katrina hit, there was no rescue of those very people who had seasoned the environment for so many tourists. I attended a review presented on how big charity, the oldest hospital in the United States, was literally abandoned and now demonized, and that there is a medical complex which has been built, and they tout it as one of the biggest in the nation, and that it doesn't only serve the indigent but also paying and insured customers. And that pained me in a way I don't even know how to express. Why would you think that that's a bragging right, that you destroy something that dedicated itself to supporting the least of us? It didn't matter if you had insurance if you went to big charity. And I worked at big charity, and I promise you it was not a joy ride. I have written stories, short stories, and blog stories about events I think I'll never see again and some of the experiences, and definitely the people I met. I know with some great confidence that there would be a very difficult thing to match some of the characters and the color that was there, because it was known as an indigent hospital, that you felt confident that you could come. There were no stigma. You weren't asked insurance questions. And in fact, one of the things that was pointed out in the movie last night was there wasn't enough privacy that you could hear everybody's information. That whole idea, and I definitely respect HIPAA laws and trying to keep things personal and confidential, but everything has its extreme. America has become such an individualized, isolated, selfish place that it really isn't much fun anymore. I can remember when you hear singing and you went towards the singing. I mean, anyone that you interview that was old school jazz, old school anything, they learned it by observing first and then slowly sliding in and being accepted. If you talk about the pianists and the guitarists and the saxophone players, the tap dancers, they didn't go to some Ivy League private club, dues-demanding, orchestrated, choreographed situation. They were on some street corner, or they peeked through some window. Even Elvis Presley admitted peeking in at black churches and watching them, how they played, and hearing their music. Greatness does not require isolation and dues. There's a humanness in understanding and compassion. When I practiced medicine at Big Charity, and I had to ask personal questions, it taught me how to lower my voice. It forced me to come in closer to the person with whom I was speaking. And when I had written what they told me, I'd quietly read it back for clarity. I didn't shout across a room or try to keep them 3 to 6 feet away from me through a glass panel. They were a human being, and I often felt their warmth and smelled their aroma, because they're human just like me. I hear people talk about the good old days. And when they talk about it, they're not ignoring the hardship. Was it difficult to work the ER rotations at Big Charity? Yes, it was. We, each intern or resident, had eight or nine cubicles, and you ran from bed to bed to bed, and you ran down and you transferred samples of urine and samples of blood that you had to collect yourself. And you had to get the data, and you read it on your way back to your corridor, and you recorded it onto a chart as quickly as you could. And once you'd gotten the patient either admitted to the hospital or cleared to go home, they rolled another one in. It really was a full 12-hour shift. There was no downtime. There were those who spoke Cajun, French, English, some who wouldn't talk to you at all. Some had their restraints in place, and you were afraid to release that arm to take the blood. I never even knew how I was supposed to help a man urinate into what we call a duck or a uriner, because I'd never had to do that before. And a man would tell me, honey, I can't do it laying down, and I'd have to get security to come in to assist because I didn't have the authority to undo his hands and let him set up. That was Big Charity. And now it's just an empty tomb sitting in the middle of New Orleans, because there were some politicians who decided they wanted to build a new and modern center, and one of the politicians spoke and said, "Now there's all private rooms." And the beautiful environment. And that person probably wasn't born when so many people were getting the real flavor of health care. There was no disparity. From 1937, when Charity First was commissioned by the convent, and most of the nurses were nuns, they made a comment that black and white didn't matter. So even in the time of Jim Crow, in the heart of Jim Crow country in Louisiana, there was a place where black people got the same kind of health as someone else who was poor, because it was run by people who answered to a higher power and it didn't have dollar signs on it. By nature, I guess I don't like the bullies and anyone who's a bully makes me sad. I watched the campaign and there was some confrontation to Hillary Clinton, and I know they want her to be the front runner for Democrats, and they want the black Americans to run to her and say yes, because there's so many historical firsts. She'd be a first female president, and of course Bill would be the first man of a country. It would be like Britain, where they have the queen and then her husband. But to get where they are, the Clintons have done a lot of harsh, cruel, hateful things. And because they are rich or wealthy in America, they will tell you, don't mind it. That's okay. Look away. They can. They're supposed to. There were a few who confronted her in South Carolina on statements she made when her husband, then president, was busy incarcerating black Americans at a rate unprecedented in the world, where he was saying, third strike, you go away for life. And that totally ignores the Constitution that says you can face the person who's saying you've offended them and you have a right of your peers to judge you. That was stripped away, just like that one decision, one person. Bill Clinton did it. And now when he wants his wife to come in to the White House, he says, yes, I did, and I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Interesting, those two words, or if you want to say three, you count the hyphenated. It doesn't fix anything. I've talked and counseled to some who, particularly in couples therapy, when either the wife or husband has strayed and they want to fix things back up and they say, I'm sorry, and they're coming to counseling. And I remember asking, I said, when you say you are sorry, do you realize that what you're doing is admitting what your spouse already knew? You were wrong. I'm sorry is just saying, okay, I agree that you know and I'm admitting I was wrong. There is no repair there. And admission doesn't fix the problem. There are many counselors who say you can't fix what you don't admit, but they certainly don't mean to tell you that by admitting it, you have fixed it. And I look at how they stand up and say, I was wrong to do this, and I'm sorry. And then they move right on. And they ask, why are you still angry? Or why are you so hostile? I like that term. As if the words, I'm sorry, repairs the damage, fixes the defeat. How many families since Clinton has been, Bill Clinton has been out of office, have been totally ruined, lost husbands and brothers and sons and wives and children? And many times the legislation was looking at crack cocaine, which is 15% cocaine, and small amounts of marijuana, and this was totally disruptive to families. And many don't know the sequelae of prison. Coming out of prison in the United States does not restore you to being a citizen. That if you are on parole, you can pay taxes on the money you earn, but you can't vote. And I keep saying, where are all the lawyers, black American lawyers, black justices, who know of these travesties? And every time they run to the Supreme Court or run to the Constitution, how can we know so openly and so blatantly the things that totally move away from the Constitution? How do you tax a person who cannot be represented by voting? How is that okay? Wasn't that the very premise for the 1776 uprising against Britain? That it happens if you are a black American and you've been incarcerated and you're on parole and you get a job, you pay taxes, you file income tax, but you are not considered a citizen of the United States and you are not allowed to vote. And many companies will not hire you if you have a felony or an ex-felony on your record. They'll do a background check, and that alone is sufficient reason not to hire you. No one cries out about that. Perhaps you'd say, well, what's the big deal? It's a big deal because there is a specific group in this America that's targeted for incarceration. And there's a specific group in this America which are denied those fundamental rights. And unfortunately, it is the same group that was enslaved in this America. The data keeps building up. There was a group on Facebook that I had to smile when I read. It says, well, black Americans are not disadvantaged. They're stupid. And the reason it makes me chuckle is the peacemakers, some would say the Uncle Toms among the black Americans who want everybody to just get along. And they adopt or they expand conciliatory language that this disadvantage is a lie. There is no reason why an able-bodied person in good health with good mind to sit down and take a check from somebody else for doing nothing. There's no reason for that. Zero. None. Women who bear children are accepting the responsibility of raising those children. And the culture in America has taught too many black Americans and others, I'm not saying it's only black Americans, I'm sure there are other groups, who have bought into the concept that having a baby gives them a right to live for free or at minimal cost, should receive all kinds of support from strangers at whatever cost. And what has happened, I have seen, and I say this anecdotally, I can't speak as a social scientist, but I can certainly speak as a black American who has interacted with all levels of people in these United States and many states, and the general thinking, unfortunately, of those that are 30 years old and younger, is if I have a baby, someone has to take care of it. Not me, someone. That there's not this sense of how do I handle this, is how do they help me? And they will get enraged if someone is not looking out for them. So it's almost as if the person bearing the child has never become an adult. And by virtue of having that child, exempt them from becoming an adult. And when someone speaks out against it, they're called racist or they're saying, oh, they're hurting them. I think we really need to regroup and look at what has happened in the last 30 years. Perhaps what was designed to be supportive and provide a social justice and the focus on the concept of mothers and children are sacred and we should provide has now been twisted and warped into some kind of awkward ugliness. Sort of like someone sets out to paint a picture and you want the Mona Lisa smile and you end up with a sneer of someone who has some distorted grin. I know America's better than this. And I know black Americans are smarter than this. I just don't know how we got on this wheel. I read how when you look at a gerbil or a mouse that's on a wheel and they run and they run and they run, and there were a number of zoologists and others who were trying to figure out why are they running on the wheel, and the best explanation that I saw was a mouse in the wild is a prey. Many things eat the mouse, the birds, an owl, a fox, a weasel, a cat. So nature built in an instinct in this animal to run. And a mouse may run 3 miles a day, integrated into their very nature. They eat a little and they run a little because they don't stand still. Too many things are after them. So if you put this mouse in a cage and feed it all that it can eat, and there's not a single predator that can get at it, it doesn't reduce its urge to run. So if you want to keep it happy and keep it healthy, you put a wheel in there, and this animal will get on the wheel and run it 3 miles or more a day because it's what mice do. And if that's the case, then maybe we need to take a stronger look at humans and say, okay, if people will procreate because that's what people do, and if some will live in squalor because they don't choose to do better, and the whole time that I'm sounding this beacon for social justice, we need to define what is justice. I don't know if my justice is your justice. But if you're going to declare something a society, now you have defined your boundaries. Because if I am to live within the society that has been created, then there has to be law. I listen to various leaders, and I've listened to the Nation of Islam, and I've listened to Minister Farrakhan, and I've listened to Donald Trump, and I've listened to David Dukes, and I hear the various motivational speakers, the T.D. Jakes, and every time I'm listening to their rhetoric, my question is, why force society on someone? Perhaps, as many before me have said, a people should have the right to define their society. And if the society in which Black Americans are existing does not allow for us to do what is our nature, then the society is what we need to get out of. Can you change a mouse from running on a wheel 3 miles a day? I don't think so. So why would we want to have a concept that we can take a people and conform them to a society that doesn't want them, that doesn't want the changes that include them? It makes no sense to me. So like they said on the Facebook group, Black Americans, stop accepting the concept of being disadvantaged. Whenever I hear people talking about the disadvantaged sections of a city, and then the next words are the minority, and then the next is slow socioeconomic, and the next is slum or ghetto, and then you get the Hillary Clinton's comment that they are predators. So each time the society that has the money and the power are painting the persons without money or power as undesirable. And if that group is so undesirable, why would the group remain part of the larger group that espies them? It really pushes me. I've never been one to advocate separatism. My father was a strong advocate of integration. In fact, I was his integration tool. I went to all the schools and broke all the ceilings, if you like, in North Carolina in my age group and in the time when integration was just getting started. And I took my lumps. I got spat upon, and I got called the N-word, and I didn't have a prom in high school, and I was told that my limitations were determined by my sex and my race. So I know I'm not speaking abstractly. And I say to you, if we're looking for social justice, maybe we're looking in the wrong place. And if, in fact, we elect a Donald Trump for president, I don't know how America can show its face in the world at large. So with that, I thank you for listening. And until next time, be safe.